Well, thank you all for coming out. My name is David Lewis. I am a current graduate student in historic preservation at Boston University. And this is a project through which I was able to combine my personal passion for baseball history and ballpark research with my sort of academic and professional interest in historic preservation. And to do so right under my own nose at Boston University was very exciting. So tucked away in Boston University's West Campus is a unique piece of American history. What is now Nickerson Field, home to BU soccer and lacrosse teams, was once Braves Field, a major league ballpark, although you might not know this just by walking by. I argue that the stadium has been the subject of an adaptive reuse project and that the site has been given a new purpose and new meaning while much of the original historic character remains. The transformation of Braves Field into Nickerson Field is a unique example of adaptive reuse because it happened over an extended period of time and lacked a complete design plan from the outset. Despite this, I believe that the project turned out to be a real success for the school. Analyzing this transformation further will shed light on the evolution of Boston University's campus and provide valuable insight for future adaptive reuse and urban planning decisions. So starting with a look at the history of the Braves Field site, this land was first developed in the 1890s. Originally, it was the Alston Golf Club, and hopefully for the purposes of helping you visualize some of this, some of you guys will have been to the site of Braves Field, and if you have, I think it'd be really tough to picture a golf course in Boston right along Com Ave, but that's what was there for a period of time. And during this time, the Boston National League team and their series of nicknames played at the South End Grounds, which is actually a series of three stadiums within one site, or at different times three stadiums, on one site in Boston's South End neighborhood. The second of which you see here really was an architectural marvel and, in my opinion, one of the most beautifully designed ballparks of all time, but eventually was lost, at least in part, to a fire. In 1914, due to a desire to have a larger stadium, one he could design himself and have more space and bigger crowds, Braves owner James Gaffney acquired the site of the Alston Golf Club and planned to build a new stadium for his newly named Braves. Ground broke at Braves Field on March 20th, 1915, and just under 5 months later, which is an incredibly quick turnaround time, Braves Field officially opened to a crowd of 46,000 on August 18th, 1915. Looking at this slide, I want you to take note of two things on this picture on the far right. The building on the left side, that sort of Spanish colonial style building, was the original front office and ticket offices at Braves Field, and through those archways people entered and exited the games. And just to the right of that, that grandstand you see is still, is that grandstand is of note, as those two buildings are still standing on the site, and I'll be referencing them later. So, Braves Field saw a number of really incredible events, many of which you can read about in Saber's own book about the field. But just looking at a few of them, importantly, include the longest game in AL-NL history in 1920, the final home games of Babe Ruth's career in 1935, the 1936 MLB All-Star Game, which featured a number of Hall of Famers, including a rookie Joe DiMaggio, and it also saw Lou Gehrig hit a home run. In 1948, the Boston Braves faced off against the Cleveland Indians in the World Series, three games of which, including the deciding sixth game, were held at Braves Field. In 1950, Sam Jethro debuted for the Boston Red Sox, or the Boston Braves, breaking the sort of professional color barrier in Boston 9 years prior to the Red Sox. And in March 1953, during spring training, the Braves owner Lou Perini announced the team would be moving to Milwaukee effective immediately, leaving Boston as preparations were being made for the forthcoming season. Now, Boston University's association with the site began prior to the Braves leaving town, and we're more than just geographical proximity. Starting in the fall of 1920, Boston University began playing football games at the site. They had their own field, as I'll get to, but they played a series of home games there, as well as away games against Boston College and other local schools and some neutral site games. This continued between 1920 and up until BU purchasing the field. Now, in the post-war era, Boston University was expanding rapidly, thanks in large part to the GI Bill. They needed a place to sort of put all these students in and host classrooms, and in 1952, Boston University expanded from its home base in the sort of Kenmore Square area near Fenway Park in Boston down towards Braves Field. They purchased their first property west of the Boston University Bridge going down towards Alston and Brighton with this building here, 855 Commonwealth Avenue. This is a former Buick dealership. Boston University still owns this building today. It is the site of their College of Fine Arts and actually has undergone some renovation and recently won some historic preservation awards of its own. Now, in the summer of 1953, again, at this time, Boston University's big sport is football, which is kind of hard to believe if you know anything about BU athletics today. But at this time, the home field that the BU football Terriers played at was Nickerson Field in Weston, Massachusetts, which is a city west of the city of Boston. In the summer of 1953, shortly after the Braves left town and left Braves Field vacant, the state of Massachusetts took the site of BU's Nickerson Field via eminent domain in order to construct State Route 128. This therefore left BU without a football field and left a sort of vacant stadium right on their own campus, which was sort of left this perfect marriage for them to acquire the field, although there had been some speculation prior to this that BU may eventually purchase the site. On July 30th, 1953, Boston University officially completed the purchase of Braves Field. I've seen different figures for the exact number, but the number I was given from Boston University's internal memos was $430,000 for the site of the field and all of the grandstand structures. Now, BU began molding the site into their own right away, and in 1955, they began demolition of the left field grandstand as well as the home plate pavilion and outfield bleachers known as the jury box to create space for dorms and football facilities. So I started at the beginning of this presentation by saying that I argue that this project can qualify as an adaptive reuse project. So what is adaptive reuse? Adaptive reuse can sort of be defined broadly and in a number of ways, but loosely it's the process of rehabilitating a historic structure for a new use. Adaptive reuse serves to preserve the existing structure and maintain the historic and aesthetic character of a neighborhood and surrounding community while offering a new use that's often more relevant and much more needed. I think a lot of the projects we see that fall into the fall under adaptive reuse include industrial buildings and mills and factories and sometimes even schools that are converted into apartments. This is a fun example here. This is the Salem Jail in Salem, Massachusetts that's been converted into a series of apartments for those who want to live in a jail. Adaptive reuse is also can be a cost-effective mode of development as it can save on material, labor, and demolition costs. And additionally, new expenses when constructing a adaptive reuse project can qualify for tax credits both at the state and federal levels. All right, so Boston University had ambitious plans for the reuse of Braves Field and sort of made them public pretty much right away. Shortly after the university acquired the property in 1953, articles ran in both the school newspaper and in the Boston Globe and other local media outlets laying out their ideas for the property. Boston University pretty much immediately saw this site as the central location for all of their athletic facilities going forward and planned to host, if they could, all of their teams there, which again then was football and baseball, track, swimming, tennis, etc. Additionally, for a time, they also considered constructing a classroom building on the site. One of the things that the school knew right away was that for their plans, it would not be possible to keep the historic structure of the baseball stadium. And they knew that tearing down parts of the grandstands and pavilions would be necessary for their plans. Then President Harold C. Case envisioned the field's role as a multi-use site, hoping that commencement, physical education classes, as well as other events could take place at the site. And this is really an important part of what this site, now known as Nickerson Field, the role it plays at Boston University today. Commencement exercises are still held there. When I graduated undergrad at BU 2 years ago, I did so right on Braves Field. And club fairs and other major events that need a lot of space, as well as just recreational sports are played there. And now, jumping forward a number of decades, during the early 2000s, during the planning of the Student Village, which is Boston University's latest major residential project, they wanted to incorporate the site of the field into this project. They did so by sort of placing the buildings across the street and serving them to sort of wall off the site of the field. But it shows that this site has remained in the mind of BU developers throughout time. And this is a fun quote, "Opportunity is unlimited for New Braves Field," which ran in the student newspaper at the time, which really showed how excited they were about the different possibilities they had. This picture here shows, these are some newspaper articles. It's a diagram of the field on the left that was explaining to the students the different parts, as well as a couple different articles that explain some of the plans BU had. So BU began shifting the Braves Field site into their own almost immediately. As I said, they first began dismantling some of the stadium elements in 1955 and transforming the surface into a football field. One of the first things that happened was the actual like football team and coaches going out themselves and mowing the grass and getting it ready for football shape in time for them to start training camp. In 1960, the school first invested a large amount of money, $300,000, into new lighting, sod, and seating for the stadium. And then in 1963 and 1964, again, as I said, Boston University is expanding their student body at this time, and they're also transitioning from a commuter to a residential school and need a place to put all these students. In 1963 and 1964, Sleeper, Claflin, and the Rich Hall dormitories were constructed, which was a series of three major dormitory towers in the side, which I know at least one person in this crowd lived in for a period of time. These dorm buildings were the second dorm structure, the first really major project, and the first project on this side of campus that was built by the school, which really helped it transition into the residential campus. In the late 60s, I believe 68 or 69, BU actually became an early adopter of AstroTurf, laying it down as the surface for their football field. In 1972, Case Athletic Center opened, which really saw them realize their plan of making this the central site of athletic facilities on campus. Case Athletic Center is a really interesting facility that features a hockey rink downstairs and a basketball arena upstairs, and also features weight rooms and locker rooms for all their various teams. I have not been able to confirm this, but I have been anecdotally told that the locker rooms within the Case Athletic Center are at the same location of the original Braves Field clubhouse locker rooms. Additionally, I mentioned that building, that sort of Spanish colonial style front office building, that has filled as a BU office over time. Originally it was the athletic department offices, but since the late 70s has been the Boston University Police Department offices. And in 1978, BU underwent a project to sort of fill in those archways to create usable space for these offices. And again, that served as the BU Police Department and also the Center for Child Care Services for faculty and staff at the time. Now, the right field grandstand has been preserved and only necessary maintenance has been conducted on this site. From what I've been told, if you walk under the grandstand today, which you can freely do at any point in time you'd like, it looks exactly the same as it did in 1952 when the Braves left town. Additionally, I have been anecdotally told by Paul Rinaldi, who I quote here, who works for the campus planning board at BU, that it's probably the original plumbing, or at least very old, and that BU has not updated the pipe stem under the bathrooms there. And this quote I have here from Rinaldi, he calls it a junk shop of approaches to solve for a very dense campus, which I think is a very astute way of summing up what happened here. Boston University obviously is in a very dense setting in the city of Boston. It needed to figure out a way to solve for a variety of problems they had. They needed athletic facilities, but they also needed a place for people to live and a place where people could congregate. And through these series of minor projects at Braves Field, they were able to do that and create this really important campus center. And as you see here, this is one of the things I like most about what's been done at Braves Field, is that the new construction, which you see on the right, has been done in a way that emulates the original aerial look, this sort of horseshoe of a grandstand. You can see that with these pictures here. So as I said, this project does not fit into sort of the traditional definition at times of adaptive reuse. However, it does follow some of the guidance and principles that are standards. The project fits within the Secretary of the Interior Standards for Rehabilitation, which are sort of the golden rules of historic preservation in the United States. The property retains its historic use as an athletic field. Additionally, historic features are repaired and not replaced when maintenance is needed. And the new construction that has been done there is done in a way that does not attempt to replicate the historical fabric. So the new buildings that are there, the dorms and the athletic center, don't try to replicate that architectural styling of the original field. By looking at them, you can tell that those are two different periods of architectural styles. Additionally, as I said, continuing to use the space as a compatible use, continuing to use the space as an athletic facility is a compatible use and it goes along with its historical use. But additionally, changing the significance of the place through the construction there has changed it sort of from an athletic facility to an educational facility. And this sort of, there is room within historic preservation to allow for that when changes to a site change the significance. And it's really become historic in its own right as an educational center. Now, I will say that the majority of historic structures have been removed, and the modifications to the site do lack reversibility, so you couldn't sort of revert them and bring Graves Field back, which would be considered unacceptable under a variety of historic preservation legislation. It does, however, align with the idea that there are many ways to achieve density, which is an important part of urban planning, and additionally, it provides this idea of layers of architectural history. As I said, you can see different styles throughout the times as you walk around the site. Now, I argue that the effect of the Bracefield had a huge effect on the Boston University campus, and it served to ground Boston University within the city of Boston along Commonwealth Avenue, allowing BU to buck the trend of urban sprawl and remain a key part of the city of Boston. As I said, it was the second land acquisition west of the BU Bridge. Additionally, 10 of Boston University's 110 current acres of land came from this purchase alone. Soon after purchasing the site, the university began planning to move all of their other sort of satellite campuses right along Commonwealth Avenue. Additionally, as I said, they began holding non-athletic events at the field, which is still one of the major parts of what this site provides for the campus today. I think an important part also is that athletic events were now able to be held on campus instead of miles away, which boosted both attendance at these events and also boosted school spirit and sort of created a much better energy on campus. Going down, these are some fun articles. This is a fun political cartoon on the left that suggests after BU bought Graves Field that they were going to buy the Bunker Hill Monument and all the rest of Boston. And then that article on the right talks about some other plans as well. Now, I think another important part of historic preservation is being able to commemorate the history of the site, even if parts are removed, and Boston University has been able to do this well. Photographs have been hung within the original grandstand, which depict Braves history, as well as BU history and a variety of events that have taken place at the field. A plaque has been hung on the exterior of the grandstand to honor the 100th year anniversary of the field in 2015. Additionally, the alleyway behind the stadium was renamed Braves Field Way, and that is the original sort of site of the trolley loop that brought fans right to the gates of the stadium. Additionally, there's a plaque erected in the courtyard behind the grandstand, which actually was done through a Saber initiative, which details the history of the site. And in 2022, just a few weeks ago, Boston University put new AstroTurf or artificial turf on the site, and in doing so, placed a marker at the original site of the Braves Field home plate, which is very exciting. I was very excited to see them embrace the stadium and hopefully ensure that that'll ensure the long-term preservation of the site. Here are some pictures of those commemorative elements. There's pictures on the top left, as well as the various plaques, and in the middle there is a screenshot of a tweet when Boston University announced their home plate marker. You can see it in the top left photo of that there. It's sort of just behind the field of play. Now, I think when looking at this project, and a big part of why I want to do this is see what other examples were out there and how this concept of adaptive reuse within baseball stadium design could be looked at going forward. A great example of this, in my opinion, is Busch Stadium in Indianapolis. Busch Stadium was a minor league and Negro League stadium that stood for years in Indianapolis, but after its tenants left for a new stadium, sat vacant for a time. The outfield grass was actually used as a parking lot for the Cash for Clunkers program, but there was no real plan for this site. In 2013, a group came in and underwent this adaptive reuse project to convert the site into a series of apartments. You can see here the original facade of the grandstand has been kept, and an addition has been added to create these apartment units, and additionally, a new building has been constructed in the outfield, but it provides people a unique living experience within a historic structure and also maintains the original character of the site by creating a park out of the outfield grass, which I think is really fantastic. Additionally, even if you're not going to sort of use an old ballpark as an adaptive reuse, I think it's important to look at how we can look at adaptive reuse when designing new ballparks. This has been done in Petco Park in San Diego, as well as Oriole Park right here in Baltimore. We all sat right in front of the B&O warehouse last night. I think this is a really important and unique design feature that can make ballparks feel a bit more like they fit within the cities that they are in and that they are really a part of their community. So looking further, going forward, I think one major thing to sort of ponder and something I think about a lot is how could this process of reuse have been approached differently, and was it possible for Boston University to sort of reach the same ends that they did without sacrificing as much of the historic structure? Additionally, I think it's interesting to think, like, could this project happen again? If the Red Sox left town, would there be any way they could preserve Fenway Park, or would they just mow it down and build up something, you know, a huge apartment building. I'd like to know and like to see if ballpark architects continue to incorporate adaptive reuse into the design of new stadiums, or as stadiums sort of continue to get more futuristic, if it'll go in that direction. And whether adaptive reuse will be a realistic option for the modern Major League ballpark, especially those that are large in scale and surrounded primarily by parking lots. In conclusion, though seemingly accidental through its junk shop of designs and approaches, the transformation of Braves Field into Nickerson Field and the center of Boston University's West Campus has proved to be an excellent example of adaptive reuse in urban planning. It has solved an issue of lack of housing while still providing adequate outdoor space for recreational activities. Furthermore, it retained key pieces of the historic structure while paying homage to and informing visitors about what parts were removed. Importantly, through the adaptive reuse of Braves Field, Boston University was able to buck the trend of urban sprawl and remain a part of the city of Boston. The adaptive reuse of Braves Field may not be what we think about when we imagine the ideal adaptive reuse projects, but its results should be what we strive for. Thank you.
Two simple questions.
Absolutely.
The first one is, maybe some of the New Englanders can help me out here. Did the early New England Patriots ever play on Oakland?
Yes, the first game that the New England Patriots ever played was at Braves Field.
They were the Boston Patriots.
Yeah, it was. And I believe, I could be wrong, but I believe it was the first game in AFL history. Somebody could probably confirm that. Yeah.
Were the original grandstands still standing?
I believe at that point in time, the layout would have looked, somebody can correct me on this if you know the answer better, but I believe the layout would have looked as it does on this picture on my left, where the right field grandstand that's still there was there, but there was the left field bleacher, or the left field grandstand had been removed and sort of like portable bleachers had been brought in.
And who was Nickerson?
He was somebody who, I believe he was actually involved with the Gillette company and donated a lot of money to BU at some point in time, and they named the first field after him. And I found a variety of newspaper articles when BU first bought the field that was like, what are we going to name it? Like, we're not going to keep it Braves Field, what are we going to name it? And I don't know, at one point in time they just decided to just go with Nickerson because they already had it, but they did eventually do that.
Thank you.
Yep.
David, a couple of things. First, keep that slide there. When you talk about Nickerson Field in Weston, my understanding is that was like a practice facility. They played their football games at Fenway Park, and Boston College used Braves Field. You mentioned some references to Sabre, and I couldn't quite catch it. Is there a book that Sabre had about Braves?
Yes, so there is a book. Do you know when it was published?
It was published in 2015.
2015.
Is that the one about 50 great events or something?
Yeah, something like really great, it's most memorable games.
The other thing, keep that slide here. That's the section that still exists.
Yes, so that section that you see up there on the left side of it, and the building behind it, is what still exists.
That section was called the Right Field Pavilion, and I believe there was also one on the left field.
Yep.
And I remember it because when I was 7 and 8, I went to some games there, and if you looked in the schedules and had the diagram, it would say pavilion. And I never heard anybody use that word, so I would say, Pavilion.
Thank you.
Is there any, or maybe it already exists, any plan to have like a Boston Braves museum or expanded kind of thing rather than the pictures?
Not that I know of. Like I said, I was really happy to see BU put that plaque at, or that marker at home plate, and that was something that was done very recently, and hopefully they continue to do some things that are able to commemorate the site in some larger way.
There is, you know, there is a Boston Braves Historical Society held by, you know, Bob Brady.
Yep. Yes, they were very, very invaluable to this project. Bob Brady, as well as Ralph Evans, a couple of great guys who gave me a lot of help in this project.
What are the odds of varsity football being played in the field?
I would say close to zero, but I have a little bit of hope.
I got a degree at BU in 1985, and I can
Really, at that time?
This could be a new one.
They put the artificial turf on.
Yeah.
So maybe that's
okay.
Yeah, I think at some point during their various layers of artificial turf, they had it and maybe took it away, and then just putting it back. It wasn't there as of the last few years and has been re-added.
Secondly, in back of the field, there was the extensive railroad yard. Did BU purchase part of that as well?
I believe that is owned by the state because that's where the highway goes. And then actually there are some plans, as far as I'm aware, to develop that actually in that area, but it's Harvard-led development. Harvard's doing a lot of development in that sort of lower Alston area at the time.
Secretly.
Yeah. I'll tell anybody.
As an aside, John Kennedy's grandfather, Honey Fitz, was a big Braves fan. I think that's where John went to his first baseball game.
That's cool.
You can rest assured that Fenway Park will probably be preserved because it is on the National Register.
Yes. Yeah. I'm not really worried about it, but you know what I mean. It's just, you know, just speculation.
Did the Red Sox have any intention when the Braves moved to switch over to Braves Field? Because I understand Braves Field is a larger capacity than Fenway Park.
Yeah, it is. Braves Field held about 46,000 people at full capacity. I've heard some speculation. The Red Sox did play there a few times in their first few World Series after Braves Field was open, I think in 1916 and 18. Somebody could probably confirm that. They did play some games, but I haven't heard anything specifically about them taking over this field specifically, but that may have been a possibility.
Conversely, my recollection is that Braves Field was sort of, it wasn't as good as a park, and then the Braves actually asked the Red Sox if they could come play there. This is a year or two before they left.
Yeah, Braves Field was sort of... Yeah, it was much more spread out. Fans were a lot farther from the field of play than they were at Fenway. It lacked that sort of intimate atmosphere that makes Fenway so great. And I think that's part of, people speculate, that's part of why the Braves drew so poorly comparatively.
Same franchise, different city, different era. I think it was Georgia State took over Turner Field.
Yeah.
Did they work with BU to figure out how to properly reuse, certainly not historic significance, but to turn it into an academic?
Not that I know of, but I think that would be an interesting collaboration. Probably would be a good idea for them to do. I mean, obviously, they still have a D1 football team that can draw crowds to a larger stadium like that, but it'd be interesting to see. Yep. Right. Yeah. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how that turns out. Yeah.
Just as an aside, the building in the second picture was actually a Buick franchise.
Yep.
And the owner of the franchise dared Muhammad Ali to fight him. And they it was just hilarious.
There you go.
You were talking about Peter Cole.
Yes.
But it was his son who was the boxer.
Oh, his son who did it.
All right. Thank you all again.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.